Run! Go! Get to the jibber jabber!
Okay, who wants to say grace?
I'll do it. Dear Lord, thank you for giving us the gift of our sexuality.
Thank you for a lovely evening.
Okay, I'll get dessert.
Thank you very much for coming on the Jibber Jabber. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Your movie, Best Thanksgiving Ever. It was a little surprise. It was one I'd never heard of it, and
neither had I.
And obviously we knew it was on Amazon Prime, but we couldn't get it here, so you were nice enough to send us a private Vimeo link to watch it, and I really enjoyed it, man. It was a fucking funny movie. When did you start, when did the idea for that movie kind of come to you, because you obviously wrote it and produced it? Go back to the beginning of the
So
idea.
One of the first frames, do you want me to get into this now?
Go for it.
Yeah.
Okay. The first frame of the film, it says based on a bunch of shit you just can't make up, right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's the first comedic attempt in the film. However, it's based on a true story. And this film is based on a true story. And I've been at odds because I usually don't disclose publicly what that true story is, but privately, if I meet people, I'll tell them the most outrageous thing in the film that you would never imagine would even be the true story is the true story. It's the guest house scene and the squirt scene.
No way.
So,
we need evidence.
So just to give you a little backstory, because I know no one in my family is going to hear this. In 2008, right, I'm not a writer. I'm an aspiring actor at the time, but that has nothing to do with this. It's just where I am in terms of the creative process. So I leave Michigan in 2005 to go to New York. A year and a half later, I'm in Los Angeles trying to find my ass with both hands of how to navigate the entertainment industry. So finally, you know, you make friends and you build a little community or whatever. And I did some work at that point. But up until 2008, I was still sort of in the figuring out stage. Hadn't done a lot. I did some TV. So Thanksgiving of 2008 rolls around. My brother, who is 7 years my senior, is supposed to come to Los Angeles to spend Thanksgiving with me. But he also has a mutual friend that he went to college with living in LA that I'm an acquaintance of. And then a friend up north, who is in the film, Larry and his new girlfriend, Margaret. But for the sake of the innocent, I will not disclose their real names, but they're pretty close. Lawrence and Martha. Anyway, so they come down. Everyone's going to spend Thanksgiving, right? We're going to just drink. And Thanksgiving, people don't understand. People know what Thanksgiving is around the world, but people don't really understand. It's a slobs-like paradise. It's just you eat like a fucking pig, and you watch American football, and you watch a movie. That's Thanksgiving. It's literally you dress like an asshole. That's it. We were dressed pretty nice in the film by all accounts. So in any event, we end up, my brother doesn't make the trip. This is real life, obviously not in the film. He doesn't make the trip. He has a completely different movie in the making of a personal disaster. So he fucked up and he couldn't make it. I end up entertaining his friends. These guys are acquaintances of mine. So long story short, we go to this Brazilian restaurant. I don't know if you guys have in your neck of the woods, called Fogo de Chão, and just eat a Brazilian barbecue. It's just like 15 pounds of meat in one sitting. So we have a gluttonous good time. Then we start drinking and we are at a guy who I played in the film. His name is Weber. Chris Webber, he's the guy that I play. We're at his guest house where he lives with his future fiance at the time. It was just his girlfriend. And we're drinking and watching football, and all these things unfold, which I don't need to explain. It's literally verbatim what happened in the guest house. Like, that was in 2008. So we lived through that. And in real life, there was no real 10-yard squirt, but all the dialogue was real and the action was real. So for the sake of dramatization, we had to add a 10-yard squirt. And obviously, it's very funny and effective. So anyway, I'll end it here basically saying, in real life, it was a bit of an underwhelming ordeal that took place. But in actuality, the dialogue, that wasn't my dialogue. That's Weber's dialogue. Can't squirt 10 yards. That's a first down. All these football innuendos. And I had my part, but essentially I would have been Kevin in the real life scenario. I just didn't catch my love of my life banging, you know, my muscular fitness model friend the day before. It's just,
oh, man.
That happened to me 3 years earlier.
Do you know
that scene happens, and then I end up going a year and a half later. I start reading about screenwriting, and I start realizing I have to do more. And what I did was I wrote that scene. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And then I'll save some more explanation for, I'll let you guys have a chance. But that's the genesis of how, like, that's the best Thanksgiving ever. Where did this thing come from? Because Weber and I were looking at each other. We went to bars afterwards. We got fucked up and we're looking, this is the best Thanksgiving ever. And it was fun, you know, but I mean, never thought we would have thrown money, gotten money together and made a picture about it. So,
you know, of all the things in the movie that I was going to ask you if they were true to life, that was not the one I thought was going to be true. Mm. the one I had in mind was the, what was his, I think his character name is Aquavelva. And
yes, I love him. Costas Mandalorian. Yeah, the guy at the gym.
Yeah. Now that detail, like wanting to beat a guy to death for not putting the dumbbells back on the rack, like that's the type of thing where I thought, yeah, that's a true feeling that he's put into this movie, not the squirt.
There's actually our latest episode went live tonight, right? And in that episode, we talk about the best Thanksgiving ever for our audience to kind of go and check it out. And the one part actually had me knotted because we were talking about it, right? And this was me telling Jordan before he'd actually seen it. And I says, so what would you do, right, if you walked up towards your window and you saw your missus getting smashed off another guy? And tell him your response.
I said, well, once I'd finished, I would go in and confront them. And Kevin nearly died laughing. And that was just talking about the film. That wasn't even watching it. But yeah, it was the look on Kevin's face in the movie. That's movie Kevin. Yeah, movie Kevin. The look on his face at that moment, I think, Kevin, you described it as just defeated. And what's so funny is up until that moment, he's, even the way he walks, he's like the happiest guy in the
world.
He's
optimistic.
Yeah, the eternal optimist. Must be a Kevin
thing. What's really funny, and to your point, how funny you guys had a moment when you gave him that brilliant response after I finished. You saw in the outtakes, it was hard to get that shot done because that was the first take. Is Kevin walks up to the window and he loses his shit laughing. He's like, this is so ridiculous, you know? But at the same time, it's like, Kevin that you knew walking up to the window was never the intention. What you saw, what you were going to see or was supposed to see with the original cut of the film as it was scripted, that's the first scene of the film, is Kevin pulling up in his car, pepping his step, chipper, and walks up to the window. That's where it began. The whole scene before, where you get to understand Kevin's the guy's guy, and he's on top of the world, and Brad's a pain in the ass, he's just what we call in America a red ass, just always in a bad mood, at odds with the world. Mm. All that shit, that was a pickup shot to justify a lot of loopholes and elements in test screening. So just right. FYI. Ah.
Right. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I see.
Well, it works. Obviously, you get a little bit of context with it.
Yeah, I really like the opening. You know, the opening dialogue where everybody's in the bar. It gives that's one thing I had taken a note when I was watching it, and it was that it's very, from the beginning, very dialogue driven. But it's not dialogue where you're like, you're very much attached to what's going on. You know what I mean? I think that's maybe an art form in itself, trying to kind of have conversation flown where you keep people interested. Do you know what I mean? This is coming for two podcasters.
No, but you know what? But listen, you guys are speaking such an inherent truth. And listen, we're gonna dip in and out, I'm sure, of sort of like hijinks and slapstick analytics, and then some philosophical realities. And the fact is, any ego I ever had in 2013 when the cameras were rolling, literally right now, 2013, we were filming Best Thanksgiving Ever. And just to show you from an independent filmmaking standpoint, how long it takes to see these things through, which most of them don't ever get to the stage that we got, which is a huge moral victory for me and also the people involved in the picture. But what you observed, yes, it's a very dialogue heavy scene. And for the most part, a dialogue heavy film. But the problem with modern day comedy, and dare I say modern day cinema today, and this is a little highfalutin, but there's some truth there. I know good dialogue because I've lived enough life and had enough bullshit and hijinks and watching squirt scenes and participating in them and all kinds of stupid shit. The things that happen community-wise around a pub, right? Around tables and around the bar, the stories that are exchanged, the events that happen, the fights, the victories, the defeats, whatever. These are the things that make life and make relatable story elements and things. And the conversation that we have in Best Thanksgiving, again, going back to not having an ego because it's been beaten out of me getting through this project, I know good dialogue. And so that dialogue is the strong suit of the film, in my opinion. Now I'm doing the Donald Trump thing with my hand. So that dialogue is, I think, a strong suit. And I'm glad that, you know, it resonated well with you. But I think that's always been a thing, is that people say, wow, I've had this compliment many times, or observation. Not a lot of movies. They don't talk like this in a lot of movies. Yes, because you got pencil pushers who literally married the first girl they slept with, and they, like you guys, and they end up writing screenplays in Hollywood with no life experience from the standpoint of being able to really relate to the consumer. Yeah. That's the big flaw in a lot of films today, and especially in comedies, because they're so PC that they find clever ways. They think, oh, some point Dexter thinks this is a funny way to convey. Imagine the squirt scene written by someone else. It would have been a cartoon.
I mean,
automatic squirt just shooting around.
Your point about the obviously the PC side of things, that film was a breath of fresh air
for
because of that simple reason. It was like there was zero fucks were given what was getting said and done, and I love that. I love that aspect of it. Everybody's far too careful now. And it's getting to the point where the movie industry is just getting saturated with simple, just obvious bullshit. And it was a nice kind of throwback to the time where people could be a bit more free with what they were doing.
Yeah, I think
that wasn't even that long ago. You know, there just seems to have been a massive, massive shift in attitudes over the last 5-6 years, where I can't even begin to contemplate what's happened to people's minds.
I think Brad was kind of the character that the PC culture would totally be like, right, how do we change him into something else? But what I liked about it, and what I'd said to Jordan as well, is the fact that that guy exists. Brad exists. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And there's no point in sugarcoating it, because then you're not being truthful to that character. Because this guy is the kind of guy that someone knows someone like him. I know at least 5 guys that way.
That's a lot.
I know at least 5 people that are exactly like that. You see them with like on their Facebook, all lovey-dovey with their missus, and then it's next to game week. The sad posts come up because it's all gone on, and you know exactly who's to blame, who's at fault. So I think there's a beauty in kind of staying true to a character that may not be someone that makes us all feel great, or someone that we can redeem, but it's true. And it makes you relate to the story more because this person exists and reminds you of someone that you might know, you know?
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. So initially while I was, I had written a screenplay before Best Thanksgiving. It was my first screenplay that I wrote directly off of reading a book called The Writer's Journey, which is based on the hero's journey of, I don't know how up on your mythology you are, or just the genesis of the Star Wars trilogy.
Oh, mate.
But Joseph Campbell, Empire Strikes Back, the best film of all time. Anyway, Joseph Campbell, indeed, I see it, my friend.
Yes, good.
Joseph Campbell, his philosophies about the about sort of like the hero's journey and that classical story structure was what the writer's journey is based on. Mm-hmm. So Carl Jung's Archetypes of the Collective Unconscious, you know, this is that in every point in civilization, there was a Brad type, a Kevin type, a Sam Robertson type, a Liz type, a Kevin Wells type, you know, it's like, that was sort of like verbatim. I wrote this script called The Camel Jockey, which is a derogatory term for an Arab, but it's a funny script that I had. It was my first time. And I'm like, this will one day get made. Right. But I wrote scenes for Best Thanksgiving. And what I lacked was a backbone of a story. Right. So the guy who came in, really talented guy who advised me and kind of helped me put the Kevin backbone through the story to string the whole events together with, he fought with me tooth and nail about certain aspects like we just discussed. You know, like he wanted to water down aspects of, he's like, Brad, no one's going to like him. The audience will resent him. You'll lose them. And he wanted to water down, you know, different aspects, squirt scene, Sam Robertson. And my whole argument was, and this is where I basically put my artistic integrity on the whole thing. I said, the thing is, we are living in a day and age where the audience's intelligence has been insulted time and time again, to the point the best comedies that people will ever reference and remember and rewatch are 15, 20 years old from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're not modern comedies. You have an outlier once in a while. Okay, Hangover has its place.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I can't even think of the names of these films offhand because they're so forgettable. But it's like, I'm not saying I made the Rembrandt of comedies in modern day cinema,
mm-hmm.
but my film or our film is a PSA on what comedy should be.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my greatest philosophical quotes by one of the forefathers of scripting and screenwriting, he says that comedy celebrates the ignorance of the human condition. Yeah. And that's why you have to go for the throat. That's why that's why the film pushes the envelope on racism, misogyny, sexism, LGBTQ everywhere. But mm-hmm. it's all in the context of comedy. And for the most part, every instance where that is exercised, it comes back around to have its karmatic payoff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the thing is like, he was like, this guy told me, he's like, I'm telling you, Brad's too much of an asshole. You'll lose the audience. And I'm like, okay, but people know Brad.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people, just like you just admitted, that have perfectly functional and great home lives with children. And the second that they have to go on a business trip, they have a whole different set of rules.
Yeah,
in fact, they keep the wedding ring on because they know there's a better chance they'll get laid with it. So,
There's one thing about... Mouthful. There was the part where I found that I quite liked Brad the most, actually, and this is kind of speaks to the redeeming side of Brad, is when he finds that Sam actually was someone that he knew as a man back at school. And after that whole experience, a kind of guy like Brad, you would expect to kind of physically assault, you know, that in that scenario. But instead, it was like the brotherhood kind of came back. So as to his faults, there was still a decent guy in there. Do you know what I mean?
It's corrupted. The handshake that sells it at the end.
Right? Just... there is, because they meet up again in the bar and there's just that camaraderie. He no longer sees who he just kind of tried to pick up. He remembers the person that was and now accepts him for who that person now is. So if anything, the PC culture can look at that and go, well, wait a minute, here's the guy you don't expect to accept someone in that kind of scenario, and he's just kind of gone as far as he can go with that and still accepts it. So really, There is a lot of really redeemable and nice things about Brad that you kind of have to look beyond to kind of see. I would agree. because I didn't finish hating Brad when I finished watching it. You know, I thought there's more to these guys. That's the one thing when I finished watching the movie was there is more to these people. There could be more stories to these people. I kind of felt invested to the point where I was like, right, you know, like when you watch Friends and you get
go on.
Seinfeld. But when you for a TV show like Friends or something like that, you watch it and you kind of you're a couple episodes in and you're now like, right, I know who everybody is, and you've got that, you know what you expect from everyone. Then you just kind of, every time you see it, you see more and you follow them on different journeys. I kind of felt like that was the start of that for me. And that's why I took a note as well. One of my notes was saying that it would be really good to have a TV series. You could come out with a TV series with those characters, you know, and just kind of add more. And that's kind of where it felt for me. It kind of felt that there was more to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think Jordan had something to say, but just to beforehand, based on that whole idea of a TV series, I created a film. I hate saying, I've been trained saying we for years, but I'm the only one representing. So I created a film that with a lot of talented people that basically when I decided to move forward with a group of people and do this, I knew that the risk I was taking was we were going down the feature film independent route when feature film had become a cliche and had become a caricature of itself. When Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn made Swingers, which was very inspirational to certain degrees of budget wise and how we executed it. When they made Swingers, it came out in 2002. This was the renaissance in the Wild West of independent film. And it was possible to make a film like that. Festivals were accessible because they were still a very artistic, non-corporatized entity. And you could have these things be in the marketplace and then get sold for a few million dollars and get a wide release. Mm-hmm. We would have loved to have seen that happen at Best Thanksgiving. But in hindsight, a lot of people said you should have made an episodic with these characters. To speak to what you just said, Kevin, is that you should have been an episodic. You shouldn't have made a feature film. Well, I didn't speak on that medium, and I still love the film that we made, but that was an idea that people had, and it's certainly in the stars. If I get the right help around me to sort of like structure, because that it's a different beast structuring episodic 30-minute serials than a feature film, which is like 90 minutes, give or take.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was something I was going to mention, was the length of the movie, that 90 minutes. That for me, a 90 minutes is a perfect length for both a comedy and a horror. I think that 90 minutes is just the right length. Sometimes you get comedies, it might be an Apatow comedy or something, you just feel goes on that bit too long and you start checking out. But the 90 minute length is a good thing as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. No. And you know, it's funny about that. When we initially shot, we had 36 hours of footage, but when we put together the assembly, we had a very talented editor named John Rothel, who was become a close friend of mine because of all the lonely nights we spent together sweating next to the computer, watching trying to edit on a budget. John, when he put an assembly together, which is basically just the film in succession, no editing, no finesse, just here's a scene one after another, we only had 78 minutes. Mm-hmm. Now, to be a market viable feature film, there was a lot of argument internally as to whether this can be a commercial entity at like 72 minutes or 70 minutes, an hour and 10 minutes. And it just didn't sound right, especially for the money that was spent on making this. That's like a long short film, not a feature film. Feature film is 90 minutes or more, give or take. So, you know, we went back in and we had to make some decisions, and there was a lot of creative warfare. I'm missing certain hair follicles because of that creative warfare. But, you know, there was some huge philosophical differences. And ultimately, to your point, we had to squeeze blood out of a stone to get 90 minutes. And part of that 90 minutes was adding the opening scene in the film. Just to that point.
Ah, well, that's pretty, I suppose it's kind of like a blessing in disguise, because I really enjoyed that scene. So
it's one of my favorite scenes and it was not supposed to be. I mean, it was never like the characters in there, the regret I have If I had several, you know, $1,000 more and more foresight, I wish I could have put those characters back. Earl and what's his name? The degenerate gambler and then America's Guest.
America's Guest.
There's a guy that hangs out at a bar up here, famous, world famous bar called the Rainbow Room. They call him America's Guest because he's never paid for anything ever.
Wow.
He spent $1 one day. He left $1 for a tip for a girl. They took $1 and framed it up by the cash register. he used to work for Hugh Hefner. This guy, his name was I can't remember his name. Anyway, the guy that was his nickname, America's Guest. And when I heard that from my buddy Jeff Gazzari, who actually is a very famous lineage of his uncle Bill Gazzari, started Van Halen and a lot of these huge bands in the 80s and the heyday and the late 70s. Jeff, you know, he's the one who always used to say America's Guest. When I first heard it, it's things like that. I write it down. Yeah. I'm like, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. America's Guest. Like, anywhere he goes, he's our guest, right? Acts like that, I write down. I say, that'll be funny. And then that's a lot of what the collage that makes up a comedy like Best Thanksgiving. I completely abandon your question or what you said, Jordan. What the fuck did you say?
What the fuck did I say? That's a $1 million question.
Oh, wait, were we going back to the timing of the film or the opening scene?
I'd finished my point on the time of the movie. I was going to ask you about the Jesus character, the hobo Jesus, whatever the fuck he's called.
Hebus. Well, you kind of say that now. It's non-binary-ous.
What do you want to know about him? Because that's a great story, and unfortunately, he's no longer with us. That guy is. Go ahead. What were you saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these elements where it's almost a risky element to throw into a film. The Jesus kind of idea, especially in that specific scenario, but. Where did that come from, the idea of putting this guy in? I mean, it was an older Jesus, I would say. It wasn't...
I understood him as a conscience. Yeah.
Well, this is where we find out.
Well, to each his own interpretation, which I think is beautiful, because I've already gotten two examples between you guys of what the interpretation could have been. You know, you develop Brad to be this sort of like guy with zero fucks, no limitations, you know, yet you get an idea that he's probably conservative, homophobic, borderline racist. Like, Brad is all those things, but yet a lot of people in America who have that reputation have this very strong religious conviction in relationship with Jesus Christ and God, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, dare I say, and I'm friends with a lot of these people, but I live amongst these people. You know, there's a lot of really crooked rednecks in America. There's nothing wrong with saying that. But like, people who are like, I would kill you for stepping on my property, but good Lord, don't use the Lord's name in vain. You know what I mean? It's like, in any event, it was never supposed to be Jesus. That guy whose name is Kevin Short was known as Hollywood Jesus. I shit you not, for the first 3 years I was in LA, I would see this guy. He's 6'6". Is in stones or meters or whatever. He's fucking tall, right? He's William Wallace. And in any event, he's always walking around LA dressed like that. With that, he looks like the Anglo-Saxon, you know, American Jesus. Just looks that way. And when I first got to LA, I felt this sense of, you know, outrage. And also, by the way, I'm coming from Detroit, Michigan, where I'm born and raised. I don't know if you guys remember your Beverly Hills Cop, but this is the t-shirt Axel Foley wears. Yeah. So I came from a relatively conservative. I lived in New York, but I still wasn't like, you know, at peace walking hand in hand with all the strange realities of what living in a transient city brings. So I'd see this guy and I'd be so outraged. I never said anything, but I always like, just this motherfucker, how dare you? That's just, this blasphemy. For all we know, he could have been Jesus Christ himself. I drive by this block where he lived and you'd see Jesus tending to his garden. Literally, the guy was an apartment manager, and he'd be pruning leaves in this like garden outside of the apartment. It's like, this was poetic, but still, it was like hitting me over the head. Then one day, this is about 3 years in, I'm sitting outside of a Starbucks, forgive me in advance, right near my gym, and I'm drinking my, you know, faggoty latte, whatever. That's not going to go well with the peace thinking. And Jesus, this guy, I'm on the phone with someone, and I said, I got to go. I hang up the phone, and I'm just putting on my mean mug, you know, and I'm staring at him. He's approaching. He's going into Starbucks, right?
Yeah.
And I go, he goes, what's up, man? I go, what's going on? He goes, not much. It was just a very like congenial exchange. And then I said, what name do you go by? And he goes, well, my mom calls me Kevin. And I, from that moment, the 3 years of bullshit, I got to talk to the guy and I was like, that's really funny. Now that has nothing to do why he's in the film, but over the years he became a friend. To the extent that I'd see him honk, and by the way, this guy drives a Mercedes. You know, I'd see him honk the horn, give him a ride, had meals with him after a bar. We'd have a blast. He's funny as shit. The original intention was not to have Jesus in the film. You remember The Most Interesting Man in the World from Dos Equis? You guys know Dos Equis beer. I don't always drink beer, but when I drink, I prefer Dos Equis.
No.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No,
okay. I don't know that one. That's amazing to me. So that's a huge thing in America.
Right.
I'll send you some YouTube clips you must see.
Yeah.
But the original intention was to have him. It's right, the funniest shit in the world. And then when I talked to the casting director, he's like, to get this guy to show up to set, it's going to cost $2 million. And I was like, oh, we're not there. So the next best thing was, what would be funnier? Because what it was the same thing. Brad's contemplating, should I go this way? Should I cross the threshold when Sam bites his ear? So when he looks over and he gets scared, it was never supposed to be scared. It was supposed to look over and you'd see a crowd of people separate and you'd see this old, like Sean Connery in the heyday, bearded, sitting with two women on each arm and just basically giving him a nod of approval. That was the intention.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We couldn't afford to do it. So then it was like, this might be better. We got Jesus. I had a conversation with him. He said, absolutely. Are you going to feed me? I said, yes. And he was fucking beautiful. But in my interpretation, he was Brad's spiritual relationship. No one sees him except for Brad.
Mm-hmm,
but,
right.
You know, whatever you gather from it is beautiful because it is whatever you make of it.
Yeah.
As long as you looked at him and said, Jesus,
you
know, then, yeah, mission accomplished.
Yeah, it was a clear. There was a clear bit of imagery there. It was pretty obviously Jesus, which is good. But they just at that last moment where he's next to Brad in the car, and Brad just laughs maniacally and says, "Why didn't you tell me when we were inside?"
Yeah,
and I nearly died.
Dude, so that's a perfect example of like why you do test screenings and why sometimes there's things in films that don't make any sense, but they're there and they work.
Mm-hmm.
That was never supposed to be that. That was an outtake. Like literally, I'll never forget like that. That was an outtake because I'm supposed to look and he was supposed to be sitting. He actually wasn't. There was a whole different thing. You know, in the outtakes where he's like doing the chicken and playing the kazoo and
yeah.
Jesus. And anyway, when he that was derived from what the intention was supposed to be. All it was Brad was like this. And he's like, holy shit. And he looks ahead and Jesus is in the distance laughing at him like this. And right. It wasn't that funny. But the other shit he was doing was funny for outtakes. So when we put Jesus in the car, it wasn't supposed to be that. But when I saw his face, when I turned and looked at him and he was this close to me and he looked so goofy, I lost my shit. He lost his shit. And then I just kept rolling. I'm like, why the fuck didn't you tell me inside? And it was funnier than what we had planned. So we kept it.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
That's one of the things I find about that.
The hypocrisy of religion and just going back to like, you know, the risk of it. I mean, like there's a lot of risks taken, especially in the PC climate we're in, which is a different conversation that's to be had. But the hypocrisy is that most people who are God-fearing Christians who are, you know, you name it, they're all hypocrites to a large degree, especially because, for example, the pornography industry, nobody watches porn, but this industry makes $4 billion a year. A lot of Christians finance porn. So, like, to have elements in this film and that they have something blasphemous in the film, like depicting a would-be Jesus, well, everyone has their hypocrisy, and everybody mm-hmm. blasphemes on one level or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So absolutely. There's my piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. Also, just a quick note on the, I would say, cameos by pretty well-known faces. The one I'm going to talk about, one that stuck out to me, because as soon as I looked at the guy, I went, "That's Victor Roster from Red Heat."
Yes,
I it was in his eyes straight away. In his eyes, I was like, "That's fucking." And it was Edel Ross, and I was like, "That's Victor Roster. That's awesome." Then Costas Mandalore, he popped up as the gym guy, and then obviously you've got Eric Roberts. That was a fucking amazing character for him. He's basically a pimp. And he just came across as a pimp.
Oh my God, this is so much fun. I I'm so sick of telling these stories for years around bars and like within circles. Like I smoke a lot of cigars these days. That's how I deal with life. And literally the times I've told these, I'm so happy to tell this to you guys, because I feel like this is a real captive audience that really genuinely gives a shit. So just to speak on how all those guys got involved, we had a huge decision to make, which time will tell in terms of the success or failure ultimately of this film, commercially speaking. In terms of artistically, I feel like it's a success because you guys got to see it, and a lot of people have gotten to see it via commerce in the United States, because it has not been distributed in the foreign market. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we got it done is a success. The decision that had to be made was, do you make this film with stars so that it's marketable, because that's the commercial model, or do you live within the means that you have, hire the best actors to do the best job on the film, and take our chances that way? We opted for the latter. I made that decision. If I really wanted this film to pop off, and maybe we would have never met, because we would have had a massive enough success that I would have never met G, and circumstances wouldn't have come about that we'd be having this conversation now. I would have had Vince Vaughn play Brad, and I would have had Jon Favreau play Kevin. And you would have had names, and God knows if I would have gotten half a writing credit, but I would have had some money that would have come out of it and whatever. But I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. And we decided to make the film, and I stand by the performances. Mm-hmm. Now, within that, how do we get some names in there to hopefully make marketable? I knew they weren't going to be in the film long enough to be marketable, but I knew Costas Mandalore. I met Edel Ross through a mutual friend, and they're great actors. Mm-hmm. But even more so, the Eric Roberts thing, which I want to get to, getting Eric Roberts in your film is not a tall task, because he's always working. The guy, his agent made it clear, and I say this with complete respect and reverence for the actor, because I deem him as has his place in acting lore. He's a mm-hmm. great actor, but he's a part of some movies that we can agree are timeless, even ridiculous ones, but he's best of the best. He's, you know, he comes in The Dark Knight later on in his career.
Yeah, that's right.
So many great films he's been in, and they're still watchable. He's accessible because his agent said, look, we don't care about the possibility, how perfect the role is. Eric wants to work. It's about the money right now. That doesn't mean he doesn't do a good job, but he just wants to work.
Yeah.
So long story short, by some miracle with a few favors, we got him to come and do the job. But the funny thing is, Eric Roberts is based on a real life friend of mine. This real life friend, his name is Rod, just like he is in the film. Right. Rod is one of the original Chippendales from the 1980s into the 90s.
Awesome.
Rod is the biggest pussy whore you'll ever meet. Viewer discretion advised. Sorry, I don't know what the limitations are. It's a podcast, so if I have to be
Trust me, no PC watches us. They left a long time ago.
So Rod, the joke around Rod within our group of friends back home is that Rod has been so spoiled by women, you know, that he's doomed basically for the rest of his life to be single. He's the ultimate contrarian. If the three of us agree that woman across the way is the hottest woman we've ever seen in our lives, and there's no debating it, Rod gets wind of it. Because he didn't say it, Rod would find some flaw and dismiss it completely. That's who Rod is. So his famous line that he said one day, we were at a strip club, and everybody's gawking. It's in Canada, so it's full nude. This woman is a gorgeous Canadian, French-Canadian woman dancing. And my buddy made an observation, and Rod's looking up at her, and he goes, yeah, I don't like the way a pussy set up. Like, and that was why... the character, that's why the strip club scene exists, and whether it hits or not, Best Thanksgiving is like an Austin Powers film.
Yeah.
The first time you watch it, you don't get it, you may not like it, you may not respond. Every subsequent viewing, you're going to love it more and more, mm-hmm. because you get more and more, and you pick up on subtleties.
Yeah.
So even Aquavelva, his name was Aquavelva because there's a guy at the gym who was a complete asshole, who stunk and left weights everywhere, and my trainer... when I played American football 100 years ago, he used to refer to the guy as Aquavelva. He was this Eastern European fucking bulk of shit. And he always had, you know, strong cologne and just
yeah.
And it was just the worst combination of musk and cologne and shit. And so this is where the name Aquavelva came from. And then Ed O. Ross was a dream come true because I'm just personally a huge fan of his. And he's a working man's actor. He's a great actor, been in a lot of great films, but people recognize him, may not know his name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was one of those people. I had to IMDb his name. I knew it was Victor Rosta right away. He was also in Universal Soldier as well. He was the guy
who got
shot
movie.
In the eye. I love that movie, man.
It's a good movie. Yeah. Really good. It's a shame the sequels didn't kind of. But
have you guys seen Jean-Claude Van Johnson?
Yeah, I've seen the first three episodes, I think.
Dude, I don't watch anything. I watch The Mandalorian right now.
Yes,
that's it, because
yes.
Star Wars. I don't watch anything. Jean-Claude Van Johnson, one day I'm at the cigar shop and I put it on and I go down the rabbit hole. It's so... fucking good. The guy ages so well because he makes fun of himself and it's hilarious. Yeah.
Is this actually Van Damme that's in it? Yeah.
It's on Prime.
Jean-Claude Van Damme is an actor, but Jean-Claude Van Johnson is his real alias that he does like
espionage
and like it's a black ops he does on the side. He makes movies as his cover.
That's ridiculous.
That's bloody awesome. I wonder if we actually filmed Jean-Claude Van Damme last year here in Scotland, actually. He came over awesome. For a convention. And he's...
best guy ever.
Have you spent a lot of time with him?
Not one second. I just want what I see. Why, is he an asshole?
We've heard.
No, I'm asking, is he an
asshole? Well, we never got that close to kind of chat with him, but do you know the Power Ranger, Jason David Frank? The White Ranger.
I think I've heard of him, yeah. Is this the one that went to prison? Or
No. He's
the nicest guy on earth.
He's absolutely so nice. Well, he was...
I think I've heard of him, yeah.
He was there with Jean-Claude Van Damme, and we actually got to chat to him, and he was saying, you know, I love being here today, and I was so looking forward to meeting my childhood hero, and then I found out he was an absolute prick. I was like, well...
What year was this?
This was last year.
Oh,
I know. I was like, and he was surrounded by like 40 bodyguards with tattoos on the face. Like, no one was getting near him. But hey, you know, each experience to their own. You know what I mean?
From afar, he's a lot of fun. Like, his Instagram is outrageous. Just listening to him talk or whenever he dances.
Oh, he done that live, eh? That's right. Did you see the Coors Light advert they done? Did you get Coors Light over in the USA?
Yeah,
well, I think we invented it.
Sorry. Well, he does the advert for that with a mullet, and I thought that was class.
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible, man.
It's the mullet, the double denim, and the black shoes. It's the best fucking look.
it's so good.
Good. So I read in the Q&A that you had sent over that you were told when you, you know, when you moved over to Hollywood that you, that the best way for you to kind of get work is to be by creating it. So at this point, were you, was it quite daunting for you to kind of learn to start writing, or do you had, has this always been a passion of yours? How, what was it like to kind of take the reins rather than just being an actor looking for work, just to create your own project?
Great question. You know, what I found is that you, people are resistant to change. Humans are resistant to change. Even when you make a move, like leave your hometown to the comforts of your surroundings to go do something, you know, extraordinary with your life, win, lose, or draw. And success is obviously inherent within the individual, whether how do you define success or failure? Mm-hmm. Some people are motivated by achievement, and some people are motivated by money or inspired. Yeah. You know, I suppose there's maybe I always say I'm inspired by to attain money through achievement. I don't know if that makes it probably makes sense somehow.
Absolutely.
This is Brad pulling his best words out of his ass or in a jiffy.
I can relate. But,
you know, a lot of people were like, wow, you know, you go home to visit your family. I'm going to for Christmas in a few days. I'm going to go back to Detroit for my quarantine Christmas with my family. But people always used to tell me for years, you know, the balls. Oh, wow, that really took balls to move to New York and move to L.A. afterwards. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But moving somewhere is very simple. You just fucking get an apartment and move in. It's what you do beyond that. Yeah. And I got complacent after being very inspired and complacent within the monotony of like, okay, I'm doing the cliche. I'm working in a restaurant. And, you know, and so that I'll be available during the day, which is the biggest, for all the auditions I wasn't having, that's the biggest crock of shit sold to every aspiring artist. That's an excuse to just basically sleep in all day and then party all night, is that you have to have a night job. Well, I could have had a more lucrative day job and probably still done what I've been able to do. That said, that wasn't the case. But I met a girl in 2009 who was the first. It was a relationship when I first truly was able to say that I loved someone, like to the extent that I could see myself spending the rest of my life with them, that got me to make the move to New York. Because at that point, it was like a recognition of something in my life that was more important than just, you know, my satisfaction or getting laid all the time. It was like, oh my God, this is something different. It has nothing to do with the waist below. It has to do with this part, you know? And so that's what got me to New York, but that didn't end very well. But it kept me on the path and focus. 2009 comes around. I'm healed. I'm doing fine. I'm dating, whatever. And I was just working in the Tyler Perry film. I had met Tyler Perry. He hired me to come work on I Can Do Bad All By Myself, you know, which was a great experience to really get the big, you know, like flying first class and go, you know, to location, stay at a hotel and go to set and like, you know, live it, you know, and it was the wonderful first big experience.
Yeah.
And then shortly after that, I met a girl that was the second incarnation of, okay, this is more than just getting laid. You know, this is like, this is someone amazing and special. And I realized, I looked back on the years that I had left Michigan, it had been 3-4 years at the time. And I said, have I done the most with my opportunities? And the answer was, yes and no, mostly no, because you make your own when it's a creative endeavor, something like, you know, you want to be an artist, not a lawyer, not a doctor, not open, you know, run a gas station or open some business, as it were. You make up your own rules to get there. People can give you advice, but nobody really has the answer. How did Brad Pitt get there? How did Jon Favreau get there? How did, you know, and I'm pulling random people, but they're all unique in their own trajectory and experiences. Mm-hmm. So by a chance meeting, there was recognition that I needed to do more. But then I told you, as you probably read, I met Marlon Wayans. Mm-hmm. And I said, I was working at a very popular restaurant at the time in LA. I was the maitre d', which I had a lot of fun with. A lot of comedy came out of that. And so I spoke with him and I said, what advice would you have for an aspiring actor like me? And he basically broke it down. He said, if you don't write, you got no chance. He's like, you have to create for yourself. You have to create for yourself. And he said, don't even write dialogue, which ultimately ended up being my strong suit. He's like, write, you know, just learn the story structure. The guy took a piece of paper. He's having a drink in a night, like a bar, proper, like kind of not discotheque, you know, but he had like a lounge next door mm-hmm. to the restaurant. Gave him a piece of paper. He wrote down 5 books and gave me his email address. And he's like, you know, just get cracking. And so I literally got on whatever. I went to a bookstore because those existed back then. And I bought a bunch of books and I started reading and writing. And that's how I got on the path. So a lot hasn't changed since I started doing this, yet a lot has, because I'm talking to you guys about a film that was made. So I hope I answered your question, but it's just,
absolutely.
It was planted that you have to do more, and that became apparent as I've gone, you know?
But that was really nice of Marlon Wayans to do that. I mean, if you find a lot of the time you hear that big names kind of shrug off anybody. There's like a... I mean, we've not really experienced it, but you do hear that for someone like Marlon to have someone asking for advice, I imagine he would get that question quite often, and he could almost as much as you would get asked for an autograph, maybe, especially out there in the States, maybe. But you would imagine that, you know, for him to take that time, I mean, that kind of shows what kind of dude that he is, to kind of just give you, I mean, to even go as much as giving you your email address as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I won't go too far down this path, although, you know, I'm very long-winded. Right? I have the ability to give you very comprehensive, long-winded answers. You know, what you have in Hollywood, and I'm a very, listen, the pandemic, if we can agree that the pandemic was inevitable and that it happened, and we're not going to get into destiny or shoulda, woulda, coulda, we live in this pandemic age. I don't know what it's like where you are, but where I am, there's a mass exodus going on of people leaving LA for various reasons. I'm sure you guys are up on news and things like that. I get my news from Pornhub, but these guys, you know, there's a lot of saturation of young, stupid people in Los Angeles. And this is what sort of clouds the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. What you have with that is, most people who would approach a Marlon Wayans and the next person approaches them a lot differently, especially depending female, male, whatever the case. And a lot of them, you know, there's a mentality in Los Angeles that they say only about a small percentage of people are actually successfully execute having an entertainment career. They're able to have one. Why? First of all, there's too many people here because everybody wants to be famous in this populous society we live in now. Very few people are artists. The ones that, and there are ones that break through either way, but you see the end result. Reality TV is the draw right now because everybody has an obsession with other people's demise and disaster. That's all it is. It's disgusting. With that said, most people that would approach a Marlon Wayans are probably having a different conversation than, what advice would you have? It's, what can you do for me? Yeah. That's what most people say. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've been very calculated about approaching people that I've met that are high profile in this town about how to have those conversations, because it's that quick to alienate people to basically, mm-hmm. and there's a reason a lot of them are assholes or give the perception that they're assholes. It's because imagine the privacy that you have and the anonymity that you have, and that you can go and do your thing all the time, anywhere. Imagine getting hounded over and over again by the same questions over and over again. That's why the smart ones who become massively successful move to fucking Utah or someplace like that. You know, in my case, it'll be Detroit when I have enough means to have options. I'll go back to Detroit because I love where I'm from. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't recommend anyone to go there if they didn't have a reason, but I love it there. You know what I mean? It's like, it's my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with that said, that's a lot of the reason you have a lot of, listen, I met 2 celebrities whose names I will not mention, that one reached the precipice of assholedom and one crossed it. And the one that crossed it was the Lindsay Lohan. But I've seen the worst in people in those 2. The other one I can't say because it might come back to bite me later on. But but for the most part, every celebrity that I've met, dare I say, I have met Donald Trump. Wow. Not on like a real deep level, but you know, I was working at a restaurant. He came in, I had an interaction with him as the maitre d', you know, I spoke with him briefly. Couldn't have been nicer. And also the whole staff's experience couldn't have been nicer. And this is 2009, 10, something like that. So like, you know, a lot of times you have to separate the personality from the merits. I mean, you know, yeah. but that said, it's not, I'm not particularly a fan of his, but I'll never say anything bad about the guy on a personal level because my experience wasn't that with him.
So, if only everyone thought that way, eh?
Well, we're asking a lot of the world.
just a little thing I wanted to say. You mentioned Marlon Wayans. I'm going to mention another Marlon. Now, when I was watching that movie, and when I looked at you, you looked like a young Marlon Brando. I was looking at your face going, he fucking looks like someone. And it was, I was about 20 minutes into the movie and I went, it's Brando. You've got a slightly different.
I've had that before.
You've had that before.
Yeah. People have told me that before, but the one I get the most, which obviously not these days, there's an actor named Jesse Bradford. If you Google him, you'll see his face. He was in Flags of Our Fathers and all those like teen films from the mid, you know, early 2000s.
Jesse Bradford.
I recognize the name, but not the face. Hang on, Jesse.
I see it.
He's in a film called Swim Fan. That was a popular one he did, which anyway, people always used to tell me I look like Jesse Bradford. I look like Jesse Bradford. Then I met Jesse Bradford one day. And I'm looking down at him. He's like up to my chest. He's a nice enough guy, but I was like, you know, people always tell me I look like you. Maybe we should do some work together.
Loud chestnut.
if we were doing porn, I'd be the body. He'd be the head.
Oh God. So from getting your movie from paper to the screen, for you, was that a new process? I mean, take it. This is your biggest achievement so far, I think this is one of the things we always love talking to people that have created. If you look back on everything that we've done previously, we are talking to people that have written and directed because it's very. As ourselves, we've done stuff previous, just small little things, and how you feel after you come up with an idea and you go through that process of executing it and then you can set it like a trophy on a shelf, stand back and admire it. That feeling to me is that, as you were saying earlier, what motivates people, that's what it is for me. Is when I look at what I'll do in the next 20 years, I don't want to look back and count the money that I've made. I want to look back and see the body of work that I'll leave behind and that I can admire myself. So for yourself doing that with this movie and to get that from the pages to the screen, was that like, how did you feel? Was it gratifying once you finally sat back?
I have a tendency. It's just the way that I've always been, you know, through different stages of development as an athlete. Like I've always tried to do things to the best of my ability and to be right the first time. And everyone, there's a saying that, you know, making your first film, you're going to fail and you're going to fail miserably and it'll probably never get seen by anyone, et cetera, et cetera. That's a half truth in this instance. And it's certainly a truth dependent on the audience, because as I wrote in that sort of Q&A, you know, there's two types of people. There's movie goers and there's movie makers, and you get two completely different realities from the two. Now, to answer your question more directly, from the standpoint of the actual experience and the appreciation that I have for what it actually takes to make a movie. So you write the script and figuring out the story structure, which I'm the first to admit, Best Thanksgiving Ever, not the great American screenplay. But it's its own artistic interpretation, if you can call squirting and shit jokes in art. So they can in some circles.
They are.
Yeah. The ultimate point being is that, you know, when I got to meet the law firm that would represent the film for production counsel, they're the ones that do all the contracts. They're the ones that approve everything and tell you the A to Z of what legally must be done. you find out how many moving parts there are that you would have never imagined about what it takes to make a movie. I'm talking making a movie properly. I'm not saying making it, you can make a proper movie on an iPhone and sell it for a lot of money. But the point is to do it, you know, with SAG actors and unions are involved and things like that. There's so many potholes. There's insurances on things you wouldn't, they do something called script coverage. There's some process that they do. Someone reads the script and breaks down every single name and place and event and idea to the extent you get, it's called a research report. You get a report later on. There is a St. Jude's Falcons High School in something, Illinois, that has a population of X amount. There is a Samantha and a Sam Robertson. There's 50 of them in the Detroit metro area that live in this particular demographic. Like, to cover your ass in case you say someone's name or use someone's alias or use a location and they come back and sue you later.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. This is hilarious. The name, you know, Brad, no last name. Kevin, no last name. But Sam Robertson, last name, you know, like all these. So the point being, you learn this appreciation, and the best way I can describe it, from going through that pre-production and then production itself, to be a brain surgeon, right? It's complicated. You have to go to school for no less than 10 to 20 years, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But you learn that they learn that trade, and then they understand the dynamics of what brain surgery is. So they go and they execute that. Making a fucking movie is brain surgery. There's so many moving parts. It's so complicated. And not even talking about production. It's pre-production. But then you do the production. So my point, bringing this to a head, is that, yeah, I learned a hell of a lot. And it was an incredibly gratifying experience to live through that. And it was a very positive experience. And I think for all the flaws or faults and criticisms that the film has had from a commercial viability standpoint, what I stand by is we made a professional-looking, professional-sounding, well-acted, well-executed comedy for what it's supposed to be. And I think the long game is going to be where the success of Best Thanksgiving is, because if it has that cult effect and it becomes a known commodity over time, I think that's where it's going to do well. And ultimately, that's where I feel commercially it'll be deemed as a success.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, like, flicking through my queue on Netflix, that's something that I would definitely be like, right, I'm intrigued, and I would watch it. And as obviously we're British, it's received really well by us. I mean, by us too. Do you know what I mean? I think I would recommend this to my friends. So if Jordan already was going to watch that, I would have said you need to check it out. And that's kind of in some ways how movies, you know, I mean, that's where the cult following kind of comes from, isn't it? From when sometimes you can release a movie or an album and then 10 years pass without any kind of glimmer, and then it just kind of wildfire. You know what I mean? Is there any plans for it to be released on the UK side of Amazon Prime or something like Netflix?
So great question. And it's funny. I was going to say if this podcast gets enough traction, maybe I'll get a phone call from one of the distribution companies in the UK and we can actually get a distribution deal there. Because here's the thing. American comedies have a reputation of not translating well in the foreign market. And one thing that I've really learned in the last several years from trying to get a distribution deal and ultimately getting the one that we got was that they play Moneyball or analytics with everything. They do it with American sports now. I think they do it with European. They do it with all sports now. And everything is so calculated. And one of the very calculated aspects of the entertainment industry is foreign distribution. That's where the money is made. You know, if they make an abomination like, you know, The Last Jedi, can't believe I'm saying it, but a Star Wars film that's an abomination.
That's the one I liked.
Mate, I'm on that wave.
So when they make an abomination like that, even though it may not resonate well or do what it's expected to do in the North American market, they know they're going to make their money in the foreign market, because Star Wars, for example, is a brand that if you were to print Star Wars, just the name, on toilet paper, you would corner the market in toilet paper. It literally sells anything and everywhere. Now, with a film like Best Thanksgiving, the big argument was with some of the foreign distribution companies were, well, you're never going to sell this in the foreign market. You got to change the name because nobody knows what Thanksgiving is. And I'm like, you motherfuckers. Yeah. People are not nearly as stupid as you think that they are. They may not understand Thanksgiving, but they know it exists. Don't you think that if you maybe gave a shot to put something like this at little cost into that, you know, certain foreign markets, just the title alone would pique some interest and be like, oh, an American film, Thanksgiving. Now, I won't lie to you. There's certain subtitles that I would have a hard time seeing getting translated with some of the dialogue, you know, like when Brad says after the squirt happens and Kevin and Brad are in the little mud room, you know, like before Brad goes and tells his wife, I'm going out, you know, he's like, I know it's kind of, I know it's somewhat degrading when someone comes in your face, but society's changed. You know, straight guys got to take it on the chin once in a while too. How do you fucking translate that into Lithuanian or fucking Croatian? You know?
Brad's wife, actually, she probably would be the only character that I couldn't, I've never seen anybody's wife be like, yeah, that's fine on Thanksgiving. Or any kind of special event, or any event. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. On you go. Have a good night. Hell no. Hell no. She'd have been like, nah, I write.
I think she would do what most women do in that situation. They'll say no, and they'll say no again, and then they'll say, do what you like.
Oh, the worst. The worst. Because then it's on you. Then it's on you.
Well, it's funny, if and we'll talk, I'm sure we'll get to this, but if Best Christmas Ever ends up being a thing,
oh, man, that'd be good.
There's a lot of opportunities there to pay off the skeptics and the people who had observations like that of like, does it start out, is Brad currently in therapy because he's going through a divorce? You know, is that where we pick up? And I see an amazing amount of comedy potential there. But also a more conventional storyline, doing some of the things that we didn't do, that some of the filmmakers criticized here in Hollywood with my contemporaries. But you know, there's a lot of potential there to do those things. But yeah, but the thing is that there is. But that's the other thing is like that was a criticism. Is Liz is so good and she's so positive and she does such a great job and she's adorable and likable. And it's like, it makes Brad look like 10 times the asshole.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't change the fact that I have friends who have wives who are that cool.
What?
Who are assholes that bad. Not in front of their wives, but the things that they do outside the home that they have. Like me, listen, I wrote this shit. It's not my personality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've never been married. I haven't been engaged. But I mean, like, it wouldn't be my personality to go down and go that route. Then again, I haven't been there, but that said, you know, it comes from somewhere. It's from observation. And also the shit's just funny.
Yeah. That again, that's something that we kind of always talk about on the shows, Jordan and I, is things sometimes should just be an experience, especially things like movies and TV shows. You should just sometimes, rather than trying to dissect it, just enjoy the experience of it being funny. Like that opening, the very opening, tile where it says this is based on
a bunch of shit.
Yeah, like that straight away for me I was like because there are various types of people, and Jordan and I, this is why we get on so well, this is why we have a show together, is you know straight away within like the first 10 minutes of meeting someone whether or not you can banter on a different level with them. And when I seen that come up at the start of the movie, I went, this is my kind of movie. Right? Straight away. Because it's
you guys have chemistry and it tapped into your chemistry. You know what I mean? It was like, okay, you're speaking my language.
Yeah.
Now you have my attention.
Yeah, like fart jokes.
No, you had my attention. Now you have my interest.
Absolutely. Stuff like fart jokes. Like our wives are like this. Why do you even find that funny? Right? But farts. Farts are funny. If they were not supposed to be funny, it wouldn't sound like that. Right?
Yeah. We had an incident on the podcast with a fart. It was the most ill-timed, kind of overly loud fart.
Something like you'd probably write
bastard,
about.
Like a fat bastard fart. When you're an overweight child in a society that demands perfection.
It was actually
we were talking to a guy called John Edwards, and John Edwards is the owner of the Stardust Ranch in Arizona, and it's supposed it's supposed to be like this serious kind of UFO and close encounter hotbed. Right now, this guy, his story is fucking bananas. It sounds crazy, but he sounds so plausible. And that's what makes his story interesting. Like, he's talking about killing aliens with samurai swords and stuff. It's fucking nuts. But it was such a good podcast. It was a great interview. But he was talking about
the death of his friend and his friend's wife. Right? Yeah. And this is a very serious moment, right? So we're like we are right now. There's four of us, because there's us two, there's John, and then there's the guy that wrote his book, is a publicist, right? And we're like this. We're engaged. And we're talking about, so because we read somewhere that your friend and his wife got killed. Now they actually did die, right? And as he's telling this traumatic story, Jordan goes like this. The best part is, right? They totally no sell it, right? So they're like still talking like they've not heard it. And Jordan and I are like this, trying not to like destroy this podcast. And this is like something that you would write. I imagine that would be something that would find its way into your movie, right? And that's why,
dude, I got a story of something that happened at a funeral that probably one-ups that.
Oh, let's go, let's hear it.
So and we maybe talked about this a little bit in the, you maybe read it in the interview I did, but or the Q&A, but My original comedic grounding is Young Frankenstein, anything with Peter Sellers, Pink Panther, The Party from 1976. Mm. I was so dark as a child, so I'm of Middle Eastern heritage, if you haven't figured that part out. With the mullah beard. My mom and dad were born and raised in Iraq. Uh-huh. And by some alchemy, we're Roman Catholic, but Iraqi. So technically we're not Arabs, yet I speak Arabic. Long story short, I grew up on these films. And when I was a child, I would get really dark in the summertime, to the extent that I used to watch this Peter Sellers film called The Party. And he did the Indian accent. I thought Peter Sellers was Indian until I was about 18 years old. I shit you not. And then I realized that, wait, he's English? Pink Panther guy? Like, I didn't associate it. I just, like, The Party was its own movie. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you have to know what I'm talking about. Find it.